I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee, January 12, 2005. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Rep. Cornish?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Hausman? Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Neslow?
Here.
Murphy?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Sostrom?
Here.
There's a quorum present. First item on the agenda would be consideration of the minutes of January 11, 2005. Is there a motion on that? Representative Neslow moves
approval. Sure, I move approval.
Moves approval. Thank you. Any discussion, questions? If not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have session at noon, so we will try to break by 11:45, so you all have an opportunity to get. We all have an opportunity to get there, but we want to take up the a review of the deficiency bill request on behalf of the Minnesota Board of Judicial Standards first, and we'll have a brief overview by the Minnesota Supreme Court and District Courts, and then the sentencing guidelines. So first of all, for the deficiency request overview, Mr. Paul, would you have a seat? Identify yourself for the record and then go ahead.
Yes, I am David Paul, Board on Judicial Standards. I'm the Executive Secretary. I am by myself today. Mr. Chairman, this is a deficiency bill which relates to expenses the Board incurred in processing the complaints against former Judge Ginsburg. This case is completed now, we believe, completely. We had several figures to the committee in the past. The most recent one, I think, was like $170,000 already incurred, and at that point we had estimated another $80,000. Now that the case is completely finished, we are able to give you an absolute firm figure that is $199,000. This consists of costs both to our attorney and to former Judge Ginsburg's attorney because of the mental illness.
Thank you.
Because of the mental illness defense raised in the case, the state by rule was obligated to pay the fees of both sides. And also, although there's really only those two categories of expenses, there are several types of expenses within those categories, such as witness fees and other costs, because we didn't have any money to pay those expenses, and those expenses were advanced to us by our attorneys.
Any questions from the committee at this point? Any questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now we'd like to go to Ms. Zissell, if Judge Lynch and or Judge Weiland is here, if you'd like to come forward for the court's portion of today. And if possible, if we could conclude in 30 to 35 minutes, I would appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sue Dosal. I'm a state court administrator. We have with us this morning Judge Ed Lynch, a judge of Dakota County, the 1st Judicial District, Chief Judge Lucy Whelan from Hennepin County, the 4th District, and Assistant Chief Judge Catherine Guerin from Ramsey County. What we'd like to do this morning is three things, provide you with a brief overview of the judicial branch, touching on the movement to state funding, which will be completed this July, Then we want to talk a little bit about some of the many innovations that we have underway in the judiciary, and finally close by a discussion of some of the challenges that we're facing. Turning first to an overview of the judiciary, kind of a structure and organization, we have about 2,900 employees, nearly 300 judges. We are operating in over 100 locations throughout the state. Our base budget for 06 is about $263 million, and we handle about 2 million cases a year. We have a streamlined three-tier structure of courts. The trial courts, which are the workhorse of the judiciary, do operate in every county, but we are organized into 10 judicial districts for administrative purposes, and these districts also serve as the election district for the judges. The Chief Justice is the administrative head of the judicial branch. We also have a Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and a chief judge in each of the 10 judicial districts, who, along with the assistant chief judge, form the Conference of Chief Judges, and that is the administrative policymaking body for the trial courts. In terms of the trial courts and their workload, trial courts have about 2 million cases that they handle every year. By any measure, we have about 220,000 that we consider to be major cases. And even though these major cases comprise only about 11% of our case filings, as you can see in the pie chart on the right, they take up nearly 80% of our judges' time. What's the mix of that caseload? Well, criminal and juvenile are the largest two categories, and together about 120,000 cases per year. We've had a steady increase in our case filings, or major case filings, over the last 10 years, with just a slight dip in the last couple of years. But in terms of workload, our workload has increased overall about 6%, and this is because of the significant increase in the last 5 years of these very time-consuming criminal cases. I want to just mention to provide kind of an overall context for you about the judiciary, the results of the performance audit that was conducted by the Office of Legislative Auditor several years ago. And after a number of months of studying the courts, the trial courts, they concluded that the trial courts are functioning well. They meet or exceed the case processing times of other states. That our trial judges carry caseloads that are 49% greater than the average of comparable states. And that the filings of major cases increased twice as fast as expenditures during that five-year period that was studied. In terms of the appellate courts, briefly, the Court of Appeals handles about 2,600 cases. Its caseload looks like this. Civil cases about 43% and criminal about 30%. And the Supreme Court, the court of last resort, the highest court, is about 700 filings a year. Again, criminal cases comprise a big part of its caseload, including first-degree murder. I want to move now and touch a little bit on the state funding. 2005 is going to be an historic year for the judicial branch. As a number of you know in this committee, we are undergoing an enormous change as we move the responsibility for funding our trial courts from the counties to the state. And this process is going to be completed on July 1 with the transfer of our final last two judicial districts. But this transition is really much more than just changing who writes the checks for the judiciary. It is a fundamental transformation of the judicial branch as an organization, moving from 87 county-funded and county-focused courts to a unified judicial branch of state government under a single umbrella of funding. This has been a long process, as a number of you know, starting back in 1988, and it's had a lot of study and very broad support. The goals were several for state funding. First, that there would be more equitable levels of judicial service, regardless of the property tax capacity of the particular county. The notion here is that the brand of justice you get in Minnesota should not depend upon where you happen to live. Second, recognizing that absolutely no policy for the judiciary is made at the county level. All of it is done here at the Capitol by you, the legislature, in terms of substantive policy, and also by the Supreme Court in terms primarily of procedural policy. But state funding brings together in one level of government then that policymaking responsibility with the funding requirements for it, and thus enhances budgetary accountability. Third, with 87 different sources of funding in the past, we have had essentially 87 different court systems. And state funding allows the judicial branch of state government to achieve, really for the first time, an administrative unity that allows us to develop policies and practices and procedures for the state as a whole, and then to implement them uniformly across the state and to allocate resources accordingly. Cost efficiency and effectiveness. By eliminating the 87 silos of county funding and moving towards a single funding source, this gives the judicial branch the management flexibility to move work and resources across county lines and district lines to better meet the workload demands of the judiciary and to take advantage of economies of scale that are a part of a large-scale statewide system. And finally, state funding has been a mechanism to provide property tax relief to the counties, in as much as the criminal justice costs have really exceeded and far outpaced the general inflation costs. So over the last 15 years, the legislature has approved the phased transfer of trial court costs to the state, beginning with the 8th District in 1990 as a pilot project, followed by a number of other statewide programmatic costs. In 2000, the District 8 was made permanent in terms of state funding, and we brought over Districts 5, 7, and 9 to state funding. In 2001, what we call our mandated services were state-funded. In 2003, Districts 2 and 4, that's Hennepin and Ramsey, came over. Last year, Districts 1 and 3 came over, and finally we have scheduled 6 and 10, July 1 of this year. So we have today 75 county-funded counties within the district, within the state, including 8 districts, and scheduled for this July are the remaining two. That would be 12 counties in the 6th and 10th judicial districts. You know, while it certainly is not going to happen overnight, I think we've already begun to realize some of the benefits of state funding in terms of the efficiency, budget accountability, and the greater equity of services across the state. We are beginning already to share work and staff across those county lines. We are consolidating. The numbers of management positions are being reduced as we're having court administrators serve more than one county. Today, fully one-third of all the counties have a shared court administrator. And even two of our judicial districts now, the 7th and 8th, are sharing a single judicial district administrator for both of those counties. We have gone a long way toward developing uniform practices and streamlining our infrastructure services. And we've even begun developing court performance standards for the entire state and begun some of the allocation of resources based on those statewide priorities. And finally, with the completion of state funding on July 1 of this year, the judicial branch will implement a new governance structure. to match this unified funding system. And this will help us to move from our 87 counties to one judicial district in terms of our administration. This governing body will be called the Judicial Council. It will replace the Conference of Chief Judges and the Intercourt. It will be chaired by the Chief Justice and will have 19 voting members, judges from all levels of court. And it will be responsible for the administrative policy making of the entire branch. So this is, in a very exciting time, a challenging time for the judiciary, and I'd like to call on Judge Ed Lynch now to talk a little bit about some of the many innovations that are underway in the judicial branch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, thank you for this opportunity. During the last budget session, the legislature recognized the constitutional and statutory responsibilities of the court and approved some fee increases so that the effective cut to the judiciary budget was held at $26.5 million. We appreciate your support, but that cut did affect and impact our operations. I'm reminded of a story that was going around at the beginning of the Iraqi war. Perhaps you've heard it. It seems the Iraqi defense minister called together right after the initial bombing raid in Baghdad all of Saddam's body doubles and said, "I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that Saddam survived the attack, and you all still have your jobs. The bad news is he lost his right arm during it." I don't think the court is missing an arm, but I think some of our fingers are a little bit shorter. Despite that, however, we have moved forward with some initiatives and some innovations to improve the administration of justice in the state of Minnesota. We want to share some highlights of some of these initiatives and innovations. We'll be presenting them in more detail at later committee meetings because we are proud of these efforts. I know that the legislature has historically been concerned with children's justice and children's welfare, and the court has also recognized the importance of children and has identified children's justice as a strategic priority of the judicial branch. The court wants to make sure that the children who come to the justice system are not ignored, forgotten, or left behind. The court has led a collaborative effort with the Department of Human Services to improve the way children are treated in CHIPS cases, children in need of protection or services, children who are abused or neglected. Starting with a pilot project in 12 counties, this initiative is now being implemented in all 87 counties of the state. By bringing together social services, guardian ad litem, county attorneys, and public defenders, and others, the justice system has revised its response to children in crisis. We have improved screening, evaluation. We have improved coordination among the various service providers for children. And we have also instituted closer court monitoring and oversight. The objective of this is to provide safe and stable homes for children in crisis, children who have been abused or neglected. We have been successful in this effort, I believe. We have improved the improvement of children in the CHIPS cases. Some long-serving social service directors have praised the effort as being the most important system innovation that they have experienced in their careers. MNCIS and CRIMNET are also involved. Some of the initiatives that the court has been involved with. As you know, the court is an information-dependent system. We need accurate, current information for a good policy and to make good decisions. We are in the process of replacing our antiquated computer information system with a new information system that will facilitate obtaining, storing, sharing, analyzing information. It is also a vital component and an anchor for the CRIMNET system, which is designed to provide better information with respect to criminal offenders throughout the state. The MNCIS system is now operating in 18 counties, and by the end of this biennium, we hope that it will be fully implemented in all 87 counties. It will, we believe, improve the efficiency of the court system, provide greater access to court and case-related information, make court operations more transparent, and promote accountability. This has been a long-term effort supported by the legislature, and we're very excited that the completion is near. Next, I want to talk a little bit about drug courts, and I know that you'll be getting a much more detailed presentation about drug courts. But one definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. To a certain extent, that's the approach that the criminal justice system has used to criminal offenders who have substance abuse issues. Our response typically has been to increase the sanctions, increase the penalties, increase the prison time, in hopes that by doing this, we will reduce the number and the severity of drug-related offenses. That has not worked. It is estimated that drugs are implicated in 80% of all offenses that lead to incarceration. Several counties in Minnesota are experimenting with a new approach involving a treatment focus, increased supervision, active judicial monitoring and oversight. With the help of federal funding for seed money, 13 drug courts are operating in Minnesota and more are in the planning stages. So the question is, does it work? I can't give you a lot of information on the other drug courts, but let me just share a little information on what's happening in Dakota County. We just started operating a juvenile drug court there. Prior to the drug court, and these statistics are from 2001, there were 74 juvenile offenders that had chemical dependency assessments in Dakota County. 47 of those kids were referred to treatment. Only 15 of the kids completed treatment, and only 2 kids reduced their chemical use. We now have a juvenile drug court, and since March of 2004, we've had 23 kids involved in the program. 11 are still actively engaged in the program. 7 have successfully completed the program, which means that they have not used drugs or committed any new offenses and have met other program requirements. Only 3 kids have been terminated from the program for continued use or other program violations. So in Dakota County, we believe that we have a much more effective approach to this chronic problem. And that is also being explored, as I say, and right now 13 other counties are operating drug courts, and many others are looking into implementing drug court operations.
All right, good morning, Chairman Smith and other members of the committee. I'm Lucy Wieland, and I'm the Chief Judge of Hennepin County. Hennepin County, as you know, is the largest district in the state. We are the fourth district. We have 61 judges, 14 referees, about 650 employees, and have about 700,000 filings a year. So because of our size and our scale, we have traditionally been in a position to launch some of the initiatives that have been talked about by Judge Lynch. And I'm going to just focus on a few things that Hennepin County has accomplished in the last few years we wanted you to know about. The first of these is the early family case management program that started in our family court. Our presiding judge, Judge Swenson, in 2003 actually began looking at this model for our family court. It's used in the dissolution cases with children and without, primarily with children. And it's a very aggressive case management technique where the judge is assigned a case at filing and gets the parties in immediately to begin attempting to resolve the case. The goal here, of course, is to reduce acrimony. What they usually tell the participants is that you can either spend your money paying your lawyers, or you can keep the money and spend it on your children. And we want you to do the second. And in order to do that, you need to get this case resolved. And they use a variety of techniques to get the parties to resolve cases. One of the most important parts of this is called the early neutral evaluation program, and that's used on dissolution cases where there are children involved. They have an E&E team comprised of one man and one woman to try and take any gender bias out. They do a very thorough but brief relative to a full-blown custody evaluation, so the parties have some idea of where the custody situation is likely to end up. And these E&E teams or processes achieve settlements in approximately 65% of the cases that they've been involved in, and then 20% of the cases have reached some sort of partial settlement. The goal here is to get this process completed within 7 weeks after case filing. And it takes an average of about 6 to 8 hours of time to do this. Our family judges are very excited about this. They, not just because of the settlement potential, but because they really believe it reduces acrimony in divorce cases, which is to the benefit not only of the parents, but more importantly, the children in these cases. What they're now, what Judge Swenson is now working on is a similar kind of a program for the financial issues. And he is hoping that by this summer he will have mediators with expertise in resolving financial matters in the more in the larger divorce cases where you have some significant financial issues, and they're going to try and do that as well. Statewide, Chief Justice Flatt did sign an order launching pilot programs in the 1st, 2nd, part of the 9th and 10th judicial districts, trying to encourage some of the other districts to adopt this process. The other area that I'm going to talk briefly about is our community court and our mental health court. As many of you know, our community court actually began almost 6 years ago. And at the time it started, it was the third, it was based in Minneapolis, based in the 3rd precinct. Our court handled around 50,000 misdemeanors a year. And what everybody recognized a long time ago was you can't handle that volume of misdemeanor caseload and spend very much time on each case. The concept of community court was to focus on Minneapolis and to focus on those parts of Minneapolis that have significant issues with livability, what are called livability crimes. What the community court, as I said, started in the 3rd precinct. The county devoted some resources to corrections and other services, support services in the 3rd precinct. Over the last several years, community court has expanded. It's now covers all of Minneapolis, all of the city of Minneapolis. It is exclusively livability crimes now. All of the traffic cases have been taken out of there. We have one judge, Judge Hopper, who is doing all of the Minneapolis livability cases through the community court, and he has handling now the in-custody, the out-of-custody, everything. This has been a process that I think has become increasingly effective because of our ability to bring together all of the agency partners. We have the police, we have city attorney, the public defender, corrections, everybody on a monthly basis that meets and talks about what's happening in this area. The city of Minneapolis has now put city prosecutors in each precinct. We have the precinct captain from the police department involved in this, and we're really making an effort, again, to focus on those offenders that are causing the most problems in the precinct. One of the outgrowths of community court was mental health court. What Judge Hopper realized a while ago is there is a certain population of mentally ill defendants who appear over and over in the court system. We really didn't have any resources for these folks. They were not, while the county expends a lot of resources on mental health services, it's not necessarily coordinated and it's generally voluntary. And so for individuals who don't want to voluntarily participate in this, there really tended to be nothing that anybody could do about it. The mental health court now is run as a sort of a part of community court that is at a separate time of the day. There's a mental health screener that the county has given to this court. She actually evaluates individuals who present. Either can come, the referral can come from the police, it can come from the city attorney, it can come from probation. And she will evaluate, and the goal here is to get these folks hooked up with the mental health services that they're eligible for and encourage them to take advantage of those services, which generally involve medication and trying to get the medication compliant. This is something that Judge Hopper is trying to expand, trying to get the county to provide some more services in this area, and this is something we're going to be working on over the next year, and I think Ramsey County is as well. And I think Judge Garrett? Thanks.
I just was going to mention that all of these initiatives and many others that we have underway are really trying to target at being smarter at what we do. We have concentrated and we've really honed in on the efficiency part of it, but now we're really trying to figure out how can the courts be more effective in what they do. And these are just some of the examples of that. And I think that Judge Guerin's now going to talk about the some of the challenges that we face.
While you're taking your seat, Judge Wieland, there's a question from Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Wieland, I'm interested in your, we lost the slide there, but on your early family mediation program, whatever that was called. Do you have any data, preliminary data of how that's affected the court volume and so where you've had your pilot program going and when are some of the other jurisdictions that are looking at this going to be doing something in those areas?
Yes, The data right now that we have is hand-collected data. Judges are essentially keeping track themselves. Mensis is not yet implemented in Hennepin County other than in our probate court. But what it is showing is that we're getting a 45% reduced custody trial rate. That much we have determined. So that is a tremendous savings, obviously, in terms of time. Filings have gone down slightly, but I don't think that has anything to do with the program. I think what the program is doing is cutting down on the trial time, the back end time. And the places where they're trying to put this into play is in the 1st District, the 2nd District, Cass County, and the 9th and the 10th. The only thing that I want to point out here is that part of the reason Hennepin County is able to do this is because our county funds custody evaluations. The Corrections Department actually has a unit that does that, and I believe we're the only county that has that. That is a pretty important part of this, because that is that early neutral evaluation, the custody evaluation that's done. It is really gives the parents and the lawyers an opportunity to see, well, where is it likely to go? Let's settle this. If you don't have that, it makes it more problematic.
Judge Gere.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again for having us come and talk. I'm supposed to start talking about the challenges of judges today. I think we've already had some discussion of that. The challenges we're trying to deal with with our drug court initiatives, trying to look at new ways of dealing with those issues, the challenges in our mental health courts that we're trying to develop and find out what works and what doesn't work. But I've been particularly asked by administrators to talk about the challenges we're seeing as a result of methamphetamine. You're probably thinking, well, this is a city judge. I am. I'm St. Paul and assistant chief in the 2nd Judicial District, which is Ramsey County. It is a challenge all over the state. We heard about it first from the judges from Greater Minnesota at some of our meetings, talking again and again about what it was doing to all of their challenges, the scourge of methamphetamine. Statistically, in 1999, we had 500 meth-related drug cases, just drug charges. I'm not talking about the property crimes, the assaults as a result of meth use. In 2004, that number was 4,000. In 99, 7% of all criminal cases were methamphetamine drug, possession-type charges or sale or lab-type charges. In 2004, 40% of the cases we deal with are meth-related, and that is all over the state. It includes the urban areas at an increasing, alarming rate. When we were talking about what we would tell this committee, just a few judges around talking, I said, here's what I'd do. And I didn't think I was going to be here, folks. But I said, here's what I'd do. I'd show them this picture. That's a 20-year-old young man. He's dead. That's an exhibit. I could put in that photo the two people who've already been convicted of murdering him and this man and leaving for dead and injured forever the young 22-year-old woman in that photo, going back and kicking her and taking her purse. I could put in, and it would also be sad, to see the photo of the 20-year-old or 24-year-old man who I've already sentenced and who will be eligible for parole when he's 84 years old. I could put in that photo the pictures of the weeping, daily weeping parents of those three victims. I could put in the photo the pictures of the weeping parents and lovers and relatives and friends of not only the victims, but of the defendants. It was all about meth. I've got the third defendant on trial scheduled for next week. I could put in the photo the faces of the jurors who had trouble sleeping nights when they listened to the horror of these types of cases. I've had all three of those defendants. The two murders that were tried before these were a brother and a sister defendants. They have both been sentenced to life by Judge Wilson. What was the underlying issues? It was a big meth party gone crazy. And they killed. The two of them killed and dumped in Badness Heights the body of another young man. Where does meth affect us, and why is this a challenge that's different from some other drug challenges? The use of drugs and the addiction of drugs has always affected the courts. The increase in the number of drug cases that have been charged and tried, the increase in the number of people on probation because of these drugs, and as I say, I use methamphetamine because that is an alarming increase in that, is a challenge for us. You heard Judge Lynch mention the drug courts. We've got to deal with these cases smarter. But the sheer volume of them, not just the possession, not just the manufacture, not just the sale, but all the property crimes where the underlying issue is get money no matter what, impulsively steal something, or pull a gun at a drugstore, or pull a gun at a fast food place or a bank. The violence, it's an increase, and it's not just an increase in volume, but an increase in or a decrease in quality. The difference that judges say, and I've talked to judges about this, from Judge Sandvik in Cook County, up in Grand Marais, and Two Harbors, Lake County, who says, you know, 50% of his CHIPS cases are meth-related, to Judge Tim Connell down in the furthest place away, down in Laverne, in the southwestern corner. You know, they say it's not just the numbers. It's the quality, the impulsiveness connected with this drug. The fact that you see these people walk into your courtroom, you can tell already their eyes are hollow. Their physical health is terrible. Their children are totally neglected. Their standing, their friendships, their relationships with their parents, their relationship, obviously, with their children, are just totally affected. They are also, and this is going to be anecdotal, but it's so overwhelmingly anecdotal from every judge I've talked to in the state that I have to take it as being true. One of the differences we see is the level of violence, the impulsivity of violence of meth users. It has something to do with the way that particular drug affects your body. The violence comes into our courts with the murders, the most dramatic example, but it comes into our orders for protection cases. It comes into our CHIPS cases enormously. It comes into our assault cases. So those are the challenges we face, and we are trying to deal with it. It takes time. All of these initiatives, it doesn't mean we can put totally aside taking care of our traffic tickets or civil cases, that type of thing. It means it's additional challenges that we face, and we're happy to try to meet them. So I was asked to talk about the meth effect and that as a challenge. Thank you, and I think some of the judges will talk about some of the other challenges.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I'm going to skip over and just briefly touch on the state funding transition as a challenge. The challenge really there is change. The transition involves change, and change is difficult. I think Mark Twain said the only person that likes change is a wet baby. And that's particularly true in an organizational level, too. In an organization as steeped in tradition and precedent orientation at the court, it's difficult to look forward to change. That change is exacerbated a little bit by the funding cuts, because each of our employees are asked to take on more and more work and responsibility. And that really leads me to a discussion on what I think is the greatest challenge to the courts. And that is what we believe is a steady erosion of the court's ability to serve the public. Our workload has not abated. We are forced to reduce court staff. In some areas, this has resulted in significant problems, and let me just share with you two examples. In Crow Wing County, the court administrator's office has a need of 19 staff members. Presently, there are 14. This represents a 25% unmet need. This shortage is aggravated because of vacations and sick leave. It has resulted in increased case processing time for a simple motion from 24 hours to 7 days. Recently, during Christmas week, additional absences from the court staff resulted in people waiting 1.5 hours to obtain service from the court administrator's office. In Hubbard County, the court administrator's office has a need for 7 staff and are now operating with only 4. This represents a 43% unmet need. The court administrators have been unable to take planned vacation time, and there has not been enough staff or time to process fine collections in a timely manner. This means that revenue that would otherwise go to the states, the cities, or the county has not been processed and paid over. Ultimately, we're not talking about judges, we're not talking about court staff, we're not talking about budgets, and we're not talking about workload. We're talking about people and justice. People bring to court some of the most important matters in their lives. It might involve their freedom in a criminal case. It might involve their family in a domestic case. It might involve their property in a civil case, but it almost always involves their future. They need and they deserve access to justice, justice that's available, justice that's timely, and justice that's affordable. That is the greatest challenge facing the court right now, whether we will be able to meet the needs of the public and our constitutional responsibility. And we're willing to do everything we can to make our operation more efficient, more effective, but we need your help and support as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee of Ms. DeSalle or any of the judges? Representative Ellison.
Judge Lynch and all the other judges, thank you for coming. I want to just ask you a few questions about how certain fees that the legislature has asked you to collect have impacted things like access to justice and just the general court, the running of the court. In particular, I know that we used to have civil court filings of about 132. Now they're about 247. Appeals are now 500. Used to be 250. There is a DUI reinstatement fee of $680, and when you put the fees on, then we're talking probably closer to $800. And then whenever you have to, there's a $50 irreducible fee even for the poorest of people, and then you put surcharges on that, and you're in the $100 range, and you're talking about people who are public defender eligible. How are these fees impacting access to justice, the ability of indigents to cover these fees? How do you feel about your discretion being taken away in terms of these fees? If you care to comment.
You know, I don't have the data. So do you have the data on minor civil filing? To talk just for a minute about the civil filing issue, I think the biggest...
Judge Whelan, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Judge Whelan, go ahead.
The biggest impact we saw was in the minor civil filing. For the major civil cases with the law firms, we didn't really see a big change. The minor filing, we had a significant decrease that's continued, and I'm guessing that that's primarily conciliation courts. Pardon me? 25% decrease in filing. So I think it's a fair assumption that that's people that chose not to go.
And those are the little people. The people who can't afford, I hate to put it this way, big buck lawyers, but the big law firms who, I think it affects their sense of, their feeling towards our justice system, their feeling towards the fact that this is becoming a block for many people to having heard in a court a dispute that they strongly believe should be heard there. You know, a lesser amount of property dispute. I mean, conciliation court now goes up to $7,500, if I'm remembering correctly. And that means it's not a minor dispute to somebody who's earning $20,000 a year or $30,000 or $40,000 a year.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, it seems to me that this is an issue. We also have probation fees in Dakota County and other fees that are involved. And with respect to the impact on the court is expected in many instances to collect these fees. And it's very difficult to try and collect fees from people who have been determined to be indigent and eligible for public defender representation. So it does impact the court, even to the extent that it requires court resources to go out and monitor and collect and account for those fees. And I think it probably does have an effect on access to justice with respect to some of the increased civil filing fees as indicated by the reduction in the amount of filing.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes, we
one other, and the traffic, you brought up the traffic area. I think this just raises issues, sort of policy issues. I know from our standpoint in Hennepin County, because of our volume, we really had to look at this issue of fines and traffic cases, because there are collateral consequences to not paying the traffic fines, even if it's a speeding ticket or any kind of ticket. You tend to, you get suspended. Your driving privileges get suspended. Now you're going to get arrested. Now you're going to get brought to court. And what ended up happening, for those of you that followed in the paper, you end up now, you've got law enforcement, you've got the sheriff, you've got booking, you've got court appearances. It's extremely expensive to arrest somebody and bring them to court. And to the degree that these people are being arrested and brought to court because they didn't pay a fine in the beginning, it's problematic. We made a decision that, from the standpoint of our courts, we preferred people to do something to serve us than pay a fine. And we actually have put in a whole new traffic court where the sole purpose of that is to get people to come in. If they can't pay their fines, we're going to let you do something to serve. And we set up work crews all over Hennepin County with the idea you do your sentence to serve, you don't pay your fine, you don't lose your driver's license. So it is, you know, a problem.
Thank you.
So, Judge, in this period of time that you've been addressing, your answer to have your caseloads gone down?
In across the board,
when
no.
Since fees have been increased, has your caseload gone
in
down?
In minor civil, not in major. Major's gone up, minor's
your
gone
entire
down.
Caseload, I'm asking.
In Hennepin County or
yes.
Across the board? In Hennepin, we're flat. We're up in criminal, down in juvenile, you know, in different parts of the court. And statewide...
Mr. Sell.
Case filings, as I indicated, it's down a little bit, primarily actually from civil down and also in juvenile, and that's primarily in the status offenses. Between 2000 and 2004, our status offenses went from 10,000 statewide down to like 1,500. We've been trying to understand what is going on, and we believe it's because law enforcement has other priorities, and so for those are going down. But again, in terms of our workload, because the kinds of cases that are going up are in the criminal area, the overall workload is up significantly.
If there's no other questions, yes, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I have a request on whatever it's called, number 16 of the PowerPoint. If you could, when you come before us for the appropriation part of this, if you could give us a more detailed summary of the statewide costs on, and the numbers of guardian ad litem and the court interpreters and the Rule 20 and the informer papyrus, we would be interested in that information because... in the interim, we have heard from people about the need for many more court interpreters and the guardian ad litem. And so we're interested in how that program, the guardian ad litem program, is working and what the problems with the interpreters are.
Very good. Representative Paymark.
Mr. Chair, one quick question. One of your slides... I can't remember which one it was, but it said that your caseload, and this I think was done by the auditors, stated that your caseload was 50% higher than comparable states. So, in that auditor's report, were those comparable states funded at a higher? That was the court funded at a higher level than Minnesota funds?
Mr. Sal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, I'd have to look at that. I don't remember whether they looked particularly at the levels, but certainly in terms of the proportion of judges to caseload, they were much higher. And I think that Iowa has more judges than Minnesota does.
Any other questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
And then we'll go to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Barbara Toombs, Executive Director, if you'd come forward. Ms. Stumbs, we will need to conclude about 1.5 hour from now. If you need additional time, we will have time after today as well. So go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I've been asked to give an overview of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and some of the issues of sentencing trends that the commission believes that you should be aware of at this time. The structure of the commission was actually created by the legislature in 1978 upon the passage of the Sentencing Guidelines Act. There are 11 members on the commission, 3 citizen members, which are appointed by the governor, and 1 must be a crime victim, the commission of corrections by statute, 3 judges, which are appointed by the chief justice of the Supreme Court, law enforcement, probation, prosecution, and public defender, again, all appointed by the governor. The commission is staffed by 6.5 full-time equivalent employees, which is down from the total of 8 in 2001. We have an executive director, 4.5 research analysts, and 1 administrator for the agency. We have an operating budget of $872,000. 91% of that is consumed with salaries, 8% for rent and utilities, and 1% of our budget is for operating expenses, such as paper, which is why we don't do a lot of handouts. Our primary responsibility to the guidelines is to modify the sentencing guidelines annually. As legislation is passed each year or as proposals from the commission are brought forth to rank offenses and so forth, those are go into effect each year on August 1st. We collect, integrate, and maintain data, including a monitoring system for all felony sentences. This is my second year in Minnesota. I came from a state that started guidelines in 1993. And to come to this state and see the immense amount of data and information you have is incredible. You are one of the few states in the United States that has quality, consistent data dating back to the time of the implementation of the guidelines. So every felony sentence in the state is comes through our office and a record's made of it. And it's really good for multi-year analysis, the trendy analysis, and those types of things. And last year we processed over 12,000 individual felony sentences through the agency. We also do public education and inform the others. We do training for courts, prosecutors, probation officers, and so forth. We did 9 of those last year. We provide policy and policy impact analysis to the legislature. In 2003, we did 24. Last year alone, we did 49. And oftentimes, those are bills that you have coming before you. We do a policy analysis of that, telling you how many prison beds, that information, and it's shared with the Department of Corrections, who assigns a dollar amount. So that's where those figures have come up. With every impact, as revisions are made in committee, or from different, those are sent back to us and they're revised. So those 49 are the initial ones. The subsequent revisions sometimes are 2 or 3 times on a bill. We evaluate and report. We have standing reports to this legislature, as you got one recently on the reports to the legislature annually. We have reports on juvenile placement, on the firearms and so forth. We also do reports as requested. We did the drug policy study last year, and we also did 2 Blakely v. Washington reports this year. Anything that has to do with sentencing or sentencing trends that we've requested of us, we do. And we assist and train criminal justice practitioners, and we support a statewide information system. We actually process through the electronic system with electronic worksheets. We did about 17,000 of those for everybody who's getting sentenced. electronic worksheet is done on them. They used to be done on paper, and we have now gone to the electronic version, but they still have to be verified, make sure the criminal history is right. It also looks at the current offense, and then we calculate the presumptive sentence that offended, so when they go before the court that day, they know what sentence they're getting. We take about anywhere between 103 requests for data a year. That was up from about 75. These are from either criminal justice agencies, individuals, newspapers, things like that we do. And we also do a lot of about 3,000 to 4,000 phone calls a day, a year on sentencing issues from courts, judges, defense attorneys, prosecutors at times sentencing, wanting to know the application of the guidelines. And we're doing all that with approximately 4.5 people. What are the guidelines? The guidelines are what we use in this state as a determinate presumptive sentencing model. They're supposed to be a rational mechanism so we know who's going to prison, why they're going to prison, and we can also make changes to policy that affects that. We incorporate this model of guidelines in sentencing in this station. It's a retribution or just desserts model. That was decided by the legislature in its discussions in 75, 76, and 77 prior to the implementation of the guidelines. What that means is that the goal of sentencing is the sentence itself. It's just desserts. You do this much crime, you're doing that much time. That was a conscious decision, which is different than what the state had operated on prior to the adoption of the guidelines. They were operating a lot more on the utilitarian model, in which there may be multiple goals, such as just desserts, incapacitation, rehabilitation, and deterrence. And those goals can affect your sentence. If you're putting someone in prison for retribution or before rehabilitation, the length of time they spend in prison is less than if you're putting them in for someone who's being incapacitated. So basically, the goal there, the sentence that you impose under those goals, is not the punishment itself, but they have a further goal to either keep people from committing future crimes, to make them better people so they won't commit a crime, or to send a message to people, if you do a crime, this is the sentence you're going to get. So there's a difference in the two goals of the two systems. And the system that we're currently operating on is the retribution. The guidelines are also prescriptive rather than descriptive in nature. This is important because descriptive means that you operate in a almost past type of environment. You're very technical and you evaluate what the current trend is. Why are we doing, what is the average sentence for burglary? What is the number of people being admitted to prison? Those are all descriptive terminology. Prescriptive means you do policy impact, that we have the ability to say, if we change a policy in a state, what will our impact be? So again, the way that they're described, the way they're formulated, one is more technical, others is to look at policy implications. And a good example of this to show the difference would be like departure. If you were looking at departures from a descriptive nature, you would say how many sentences for burglary resulted in a departure, and were those departures this or that. From a policy or prescriptive manner, you look at departures and say, if we have a certain amount of departures, does our policy need to be adjusted? It appears as though the sentence that we're imposing is not appropriate. You have the different nature there of looking at why there's differences in the guidelines. And guidelines provide a standard to determine how well the system is working. Again, we look at the types of sentences imposed, where there are departures, why there's departures, and so forth. And guideline structure is neutral, meaning that we look only at the offense category and the person's criminal history. Again, not looking at things such as social economic status, race, gender, so forth. The goals and purposes of the guidelines, public safety is the primary goal of the guidelines, followed by uniformity. That's why whenever sentencing guidelines were enacted, they were ranked by like crimes or like by severity levels, so that the sentences that go across the severity levels are uniform in length. Proportionality, that's why we have 11 levels of severity. Excuse me. It's the lowest level, one being the least amount of sentence and 11 being the highest. And truth and certainty in sentence. We have a determinant model. When the person is sentenced, they know exactly how long they will be in prison, how long they will be on supervised release. And that is known up front. It's not an indeterminate model where it's determined after the sentencing is completed. And we coordinate policy with correctional resources through the use of the legislative impacts we do on legislation. The guidelines are for crimes that are committed after May 1, 1980. We still have people in prison who were sentenced for crimes that were committed before that crime, that date. So we do have some indeterminate people under the old system that are still incarcerated in our state correctional facilities. All those numbers are dwindling considerably. We were the oldest state in the United States to have sentencing guidelines, the first. The legislature sets the offense definitions and penalty ranges in statutes. That's not something the Guidelines Commission does. That statute or that statutory max that you have is something you impose and you describe the offense. The guidelines ranks the offense on the sentencing grid and determines whether it's above or below the incarceration line. That's usually done by the use of the statutory max and the length of the prison term. The recommended sentence is based on the severity of the offense and the offender's prior criminal record. You see on the grid we have a shaded and unshaded part. The vertical axis represents the severity level of the offense, and it's from 1 to 11. And the horizontal axis is the criminal history score, with 6 or more being the most severe. Then within each individual cell on the grid, you'll see 3 numbers. Those are the presumptive sentences that the judge imposes. And for the stay or the presumptive stay, that's the period of incarceration if their probation is revoked. The sentence imposed, I said the determinant sentence showing 2/3 of the sentence in prison, that can be increased if they have behavior problems in prison. They can serve no more than 1/3 of their sentence on supervised release, and there is no parole board determining release. So when you see offenders who do longer than their 2/3 presumptive sentences because of behavioral infraction that's occurred while they were inside the Department of Corrections. The judges decide on the community sanctions. That is not something that's controlled by the guidelines. When somebody gets a presumptive stay or probation, the judge has complete control to authorize the individual fines, restitution, jail time. Departure. The presumptive sentence on the grid is for the typical offense. There's no sentencing system that can cover all types of variations of offenses. Departures are appropriate for atypical offenses. They're separate from the guideline grid and available to judges to use in that case in which the circumstances warrant either a longer or shorter sentence. The judge may depart up to the statutory maximum on a departure. However, when they go more than double the presumptive sentence, there's usually very good reasons why they're going above that, but that is available to them. This is current law. We'll get into some of the pending changes in a moment. The sentencing judge must find substantial and compelling reasons and justify the departure on the record, and they are appealable. Okay. Who's been sentenced? You can see here, I think it's a very telling chart, looking at the number of people who are sentenced. Now, oftentimes, during the legislative session, you're going to hear several sets of numbers, and I think it's important for you to understand the differences between the numbers. People who are sentenced are all felony sentenced. It doesn't make a difference whether they went to prison or they didn't go to prison. People sentenced to prison is another group. And then you have people who are incarcerated. That means they were in prison on a certain day, and then you have people who are admitted to prison. These are all different types of numbers. They may mean different things. These are all felonies who were sentenced in the course of 1 year. And you can see that from 2000 to 2003, we've had some significant increases in the number of people who are being sentenced. Between that number, between 2002 and 2003 alone, we've had an increase of 1,514 felony sentences. Okay. Looking at the offense types, remember the guidelines go into effect in 1980, and comparing who got sentenced in 1981 and who is getting sentenced now, and seeing the differences. As you can see, in 1981, a significant portion of people being sentenced were for property offenses, 62%. That's been reduced to 27%. Person crimes, not a lot of variation. 21% in 1981, 25% in 2003. The biggest significant change has been in drugs, in 15% in 1981, and that has more than doubled to 32% in 2003. Our other category also shows a fairly big growth in offenses.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chairman, how do you separate when you've got a dual offense, which one takes priority in the graph if you've got one, because drugs and property and person are so often related? Is it the most serious offense that gets on the pie graph, or how do you separate if he's charged with multiple offenses?
They're charged with, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, the sentence would be imposed for the most serious offense carrying the longest sentence. So you could have a property crime and a drug crime, and the drug sentence is longer and ranked higher is going to be the primary crime.
Representative Cornish.
So it would mean that one of the reasons of property crimes, they might still be just as many of them, but the sentencing is probably for the drug rather than property, or could that be possible? Or?
That is a possibility.
Okay, go ahead.
And the other category. And the other category contains offenses such as failure to register, felon in possession, DWI. And we did try to break the DWI out a little bit. And you can see that that category also, that we're seeing a large increase in sentencing. Okay. Look at it by gender.
Excuse me, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, then on the 1981 pie, other included other and DWI?
There was not at that time a specific felony DWI offense. And so whenever, so that was not a crime that was recorded at a felony level at that time. Subsequently, when we passed the felony DWI law, it became. But we were trying to, it fell into the other category, and we wanted to break it out to show you that a good portion of that other category, almost half of it, or a little over half of it, is felony DWIs, 6%. So if we were to combine that and just put it all together, it would be 16%.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
We also looked at some of the gender differences in sentencing over the years, and you can see, looking at the males and females, and we did not have reliable data going back to 1981, so we looked back as far as we had reliable data. We went back to 1999, and we could see some changes there also. With females, both the property and the person, sentencing has gone down. However, drugs has gone up significantly. And the same type of thing is happening with the males. We see a drop in the person sentencing, a drop in the property, and again, a slight increase in the drug offenses. Felony DWI is falling into both males and females. Again, males having a larger number of offenses, so the percentages sometimes look a little bit higher. Incarceration. We looked at the number of offenders who received some type of incarceration for sentences in 2003, and 90% of all felonies received some form of incarceration, with 66% doing some jail time. And that may be a sentence to jail, or it may be a jail time as a condition of probation, but they spent some physical time in jail. 24% of your population went to prison, state prison, and then 10% got some other sanction. You're using jail heavier than most states are using it as a form of incarceration.
Excuse me, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question about the jail, we're using jail more. Do you believe that that is partially because we are now sending our short-term offenders to the responsibility of the county rather than to prison?
Ms. Toombs.
I don't think I'm a person that could answer that question. I think what it has to do with your sentencing structure. This state, you know, does give, afford offenders a lot of opportunity for community sentences. And part of those community sentences, when they get probation, almost everybody gets some point of jail time. So that could be another reason your jail time is being used up a lot more.
Any other questions at this point? If not, Ms. Toombs, go ahead.
And we talked about the sentencing data. This is incarceration data, and we're looking at who goes, to the extent that goes, is incarcerated by gender. And I think we brought this chart in because we wanted you to see sort of what's going on with our female population. You can see that in 1991, females, about 58% of the sentences involved some type of jail sentence. That has increased to 72% by 2003. Prison has almost doubled. It went from 6% to 11% in that period of time. And for females who received no sanctions other than jail or prison, but 36% has been reduced now to 17%. So I guess why we bring this forward with the incarceration of females, there's a higher cost to the state because of all the collateral issues that go with health care and family and so forth, but how females are being sentenced over the period of time. You can see that prison's gone up a little bit for the males, jail's gone down a little bit. Not as much of a significant change in the male population as with the female population. Offenders sentenced to prison. Here we go. These are people who are actually doing time in the state correctional facilities. And you can see that, again, the increase, rather a steady period of, from 1990 to 2001, that increased significantly in 2002 and again in 2003. The average pronounced sentence. We look at, this is the average across the board for all people. And you can see that the average pronounced sentence in 1981 on an offender was 38.3 months. That is up to 51.2 months. So when you look at your growing prison population, it's a result of two things. You have more people going into your state correctional facilities. You also have been serving longer sentences. When you have those two things happening simultaneously, it's very difficult to not have a prison population continue to grow.
Representative Tilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know why 1993 or 4 is similar to
1992, 91, 93. You're talking about the 51.3. That was the year you had the largest number of sex offenders sentenced. And sex offender sentences are considerably longer than most sentences. So that skewed the average for that year.
Anything further? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, is it also true that 89 was the year that Minnesota doubled its prison sentences to, which might account for that big sort of jump between 89 and 91?
Representative Ellison, restate the question. I didn't either hear it or understand.
Okay. In 1989, Minnesota doubled prison sentences. That's the case, isn't it?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, in 1989, the sentencing guidelines did increase the sentences for level 7 and up on the sentencing grid. So there was an increase in the overall sentences at that time.
And, Mr. Chair, might that account for the big jump between 89 and 91 there?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ellison, yes, that does contribute to that, that increase that you see between the 89 and the 91. My understanding of the question was why 93 was so high, and that was because that was one year where you have the largest number of sex offenders that has been sentenced since the guidelines went into place for sentence for that year.
Sure. Mr. Representative Ellison.
Do you have a chart that demonstrates sentencing by race or only by race today? Do you have that for us?
Ms. Tone.
We have that in our general statistics data. I don't have that slide with me today.
Can you share any of that information with us today? I mean, do you have it? Can you tell it to us?
Without looking at the percentages.
Ms. Toombs and Representative Ellison, Ms. Toombs will be back because
okay.
In light of the fact our time today is growing short. Also, I anticipate additional questions relative to the Blakely decision. So at the time you return, you can bring that data, graphs, whatever, with you, if that's acceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate that.
Anything else?
No.
Why don't you finish this slide, and we may look at wrapping it up this morning. I apologize that you will have to come back, but we like to chat with you, and so and we will probably have additional more lengthy questions on the other issue I just mentioned. So if you want to prepare to conclude, do so at this time.
Before, this is a good point to start because I was going to talk about departure rates. And just for your information, as many of you know, the Blakely v. Washington decision, which the U.S. Supreme Court affected the departure procedures for the state of Minnesota. This morning, right before I came here, we've been waiting for a Supreme Court decision to come down, the follow-up Supreme Court decisions on that Blakely v. Washington, to explain what Blakely v. Washington really means, because after they handed that decision, no one really knew what the decision meant. And the Supreme Court had subsequent cases they heard the first day of their session. We've been waiting for those decisions. They were just handed down this morning. Because I'm dutiful, I came here, and I did not have a chance to read them. So they will maybe impact how our future recommendations are, but that's something that just happened that we're not able to share because we really don't know yet.
Ms. Toombs, at this, then would you get with our committee administrator after this hearing, and we'll select a time for you to come back that's convenient and appropriate. Does anyone have any other business at this time? If not, this meeting is adjourned.